8% of its $1 million total. In recent years, the societies have begun allowing electronic registration, which enormously simplifies the process and makes it easier to register compositions around the world. Because of this, most songs are now properly registered, and the amount of money in the black box is dropping, but it's still around. Printed music. Printed music historically meant paper. Remember that? But today it means much more. The traditional print music market was sheet music, printed music of a single song, the kind you stuff inside your piano bench, and folios, which are collections of songs, such as Greatest Hits of the 90s, The Complete Led Zeppelin, The David Hasselhoff Songbook, etc. Collections of songs by a number of different artists are called mixed folios. Another type is a matching folio, which has all the songs of a particular album, i.e. it matches the album. Matching folios are usually printed with the album artwork on the cover and various posed candid shots of the artist inside. Royalties. The following royalties are what's paid to a publisher for physical, meaning printed on paper, print rights. We'll hit digital print in the next section. For single-song physical sheet music, the standard royalty is 20% of the marked retail price. Currently, most single-song sheet music has a $4.95 retail price, so the publisher gets about 99 cents. Royalties on folios are 10% to 12.5% of the marked retail price, and the current marked selling price of most folios is $24.95. A personality folio is one that has the picture of the performing artist plastered all over it, such as Stevie Wonder's Greatest Hits. A matching folio, which we just described in the previous section, is also a personality folio. For a personality folio, there is an additional royalty of 5% of the marked retail selling price for the use of the name and likeness of the artist, and it goes to the artist, who may or may not be the same person as the songwriter. If the songwriter is also the artist, the publisher may get the extra 5% if their deal with the writer includes name and likeness rights. But you should ask to keep it for yourself in your deal. Unless the folio represents the selected works of a particular songwriter and only one publisher, it'll have songs written and/or published by a number of different people. Thus, the royalties are prorated in exactly the same way as record royalties are prorated. For example, if there are 20 compositions in the folio and you own 10, you would get 10 divided by 20, 1/2, of the 10% to 12.5% royalty. When you negotiate a proration provision, be sure to insist that the royalty can only be prorated on the basis of copyrighted, royalty-bearing works in the folio. Otherwise, your royalty gets reduced by Mary Had a Little Lamb and The Star-Spangled Banner, even though the printer isn't paying anyone for these songs. The balance of print music consists of things like instructional music, such as putting your songs in How to Play the Nose Flute, marching band arrangements, choir arrangements, dance arrangements, etc. The royalty for these is generally 10% of retail, unless it's a folio of lyrics only, in which case the royalty is 5% to 7.5%. Print rights also include reprints of lyrics in books, magazines, greeting cards, etc. For books, if it's just a snippet of the lyrics, the rate is around 1 cent per unit, with a $200 minimum. For more extensive reprints, or a use that's significant to the story, the per-unit rate can climb to about 4 cents, with an advance based on anticipated sales. For major book authors, the advance can go over $100,000. The fee to use lyrics in films varies with the kind of use. If they're used as the title of the film, it could be in the range of $5,000 to $10,000, sometimes much more for a major song. If the script is based on the lyrics of the song, there can be a really substantial fee, and even a profit participation in the film. If the film includes the song as well as the lyrics, the sync license will include the film company's right to use the lyrics in closed captioning and subtitles in other languages. For paper greeting cards, we'll discuss digital e-cards in a minute. The publishers get the greater of a penny rate, usually 12.5 cents to 15 cents, or a percentage of the wholesale price, usually 5% to 8%. If it's a greeting card that actually plays the song, publishers also insist that their royalty can't be less than what's paid for the master. Reprints of lyrics on clothing run from 8% to 11% of wholesale, depending on whether the goods are sold in high-end stores or through a mass merchandiser, meaning a store like Walmart or other places that sell at deeply discounted prices in a no-frills environment. The mass merchandiser's sales are at the lower royalties, around 6% to 8% of wholesale, because the discounted prices means there's a thinner profit margin. Advertising uses, such as printing the lyrics in magazines, newspapers, and on billboards, are flat fees and can run up to $25,000 or more for major uses. Traditional lyric reprints on inserts in physical albums are customarily free. However, as physical disappears, lyric videos are today's equivalent of lyric reprints. As we'll discuss later in this chapter, publishers try to get more money for these. Digital print rights. The most direct transition of traditional print to digital media are sites like MusicNotes.com and SheetMusicPlus.com, which sell downloadable sheet music. That is truly the equivalent of, and a substitute for, paper sheet music. Also, sites like Tonara and Chromatic have apps for tablets and smartphones that have cool things like ticking metronomes and pages that turn in sync. The cost of these products is about the same as physical print music, which is currently $4.95 per song. To license these rights, publishers get 50% of the income, a big jump from the 20% they get on physical print. A much broader use in the digital world is posting lyrics online without the music. These are places like Genius, Lyric Find, and Musics Match. The lyrics are usually available free to users because the sites have advertising up the yin-yang, though some sites have subscribers. For allowing sites to reprint the lyrics, publishers get about 50% of the advertising revenue, often with a minimum amount per view, and if it's subscription-based, a minimum amount per subscriber. The PSM concept we discussed back in Chapter 12. A number of lyric sites aren't licensed at all, though the publishers have become more aggressive about shutting them down. There are also lyric videos, which we'll discuss later in this chapter. E-cards, meaning those cutesy-wootsy pictures of snow falling on sleighs while music plays in the background, are another form of digital print. For these, the publisher gets 5% to 8% of the retail price, with a minimum of 10 cents to 15 cents per unit. Music instruction and notation apps, such as one that scrolls along as you play the song, are another form of digital print rights. The deals range from 15% to 25%. Depending on how interactive it is, and whether it's really educational or just entertainment. If the master isn't used, the norm is more like 50%. The publishers know the app would have to pay 60% to both the master and the publisher if they did use the master, so they give a discount to 50% if they don't. That incentivizes the app developers to not use the master, and of course, makes the publisher more money. Unlike physical print deals, digital deals are non-exclusive, meaning the publisher can license the same rights to multiple users. This is a big shift in the industry. Historically, setting up a printing company, buying the presses, hiring a sales and warehouse force, and taking the inventory risk, which of course doesn't exist with digital, was so expensive that the printers wouldn't put out a particular song catalog unless they had it exclusively. The publishers were fine with this for two reasons. One, they didn't want to invest in setting up a print company, and two, by making long-term exclusive deals, the publishers could get a good-sized advance from the print company. Obviously, as the physical print world shrinks, so does the potential revenue, and therefore the amount of advance they can get. Term. Licenses for print music are for limited periods of time, usually 3 to 5 years. The exceptions are licenses of lyrics for books, movies, and things like that, where they run for the life of copyright. As we just discussed, these licenses are non-exclusive, except for physical goods. Also with physical, you have to agree to what they do with the stuff at the end of the term. Certainly, they can't manufacture any more inventory, but can they continue to sell what they have? Normally, these licenses give the printer a right to sell their existing physical inventory for a period of 6 to 12 months after the term expires. These sell-off rights are non-exclusive, meaning someone else can sell the same materials at the same time. At the end of the 6 to 12 months, they have to trash anything left over. For mixed folios, because they're so much more expensive, and also because there are a lot of other writers involved, the printers try not to have any time limit on their sell-off rights, and in fact, want the right to keep manufacturing them. When you make these deals, make sure there's no stockpiling, dumping, or distress sales. Stockpiling is where the printer manufactures 8 quadrillion units right before the end of the term, so that they have tons of your inventory to sell after the term. Your new printer won't like it if the market is already flooded with the same books it's trying to sell. You stop this by saying the printer can only manufacture enough to meet their reasonably anticipated needs during the term. Dumping and distress sales mean the printer sells your inventory at less than customary wholesale prices. Way less. You don't want this because if they end up with a ton of goods left over, they'll blow it out at whatever rock-bottom price they can get. Since they have to destroy everything they don't sell, they use the age-old theory that it's better to get something than nothing. This practice, shall we say, perturbs your new printer, who is trying to sell the same stuff at full price. You solve this by saying your materials can be sold only through normal retail channels at normal wholesale prices. Controlled composition clauses. Congratulations. Two times. Congratulations number one. You now know enough to talk about controlled composition clauses in record deals. Just like samples, you need to understand both record deals and publishing to get these concepts. Congratulations number two. Most of the provisions in these clauses are rapidly becoming irrelevant, so you don't need to waste nearly the amount of time I did in learning this crap. The controlled composition clause, also known to its buddies as a controlled comp clause, although it has no buddies except record companies, puts a limit on how much the company has to pay for each controlled composition. It used to be one of the most significant provisions in your recording arrangement. That's because it deals with mechanical royalties, and if you're a songwriter, mechanicals are paid even when your record deal is unrecouped. The importance of controlled comp clauses is rapidly disappearing for several reasons. In the CD era, these were serious monies, and we fought hard over the controlled comp clause. So the drop in the CD sales is a major factor, but there's more to it than that. Under the Copyright Act, digital downloads created under record deals made after June 22, 1995, can't be subject to a controlled comp clause, so those were never an issue. But the most important change is that streaming mechanicals are paid by the DSPs, not your record company. So the record companies no longer care how much you get. As a result, the companies don't fight a lot about controlled comp clauses. So if you don't win any other points in your deal, you should be able to score here. Still, there's a controlled comp clause in every record deal, and CDs are still a portion of the record biz. And I had to learn this junk, so why shouldn't you at least get a taste of it? I'm not really feeling the sympathy here. Okay, enough snark. There are parts of the controlled comp clause that go beyond mechanicals, to include things like audiovisual works, websites, use of lyrics, advertising and promotion, and other things that are still very relevant. So you still gotta pay some attention. A controlled composition is a song that's written, owned, or controlled by the artist, in whole or in part. However, it's usually defined more broadly than that and includes 1. Any song in which the artist has an income or other interest. This means that, even if the artist doesn't own or control the song, if he or she wrote it or otherwise gets a piece of its earnings, it's a controlled composition. 2. The definition also often includes compositions owned or controlled by the producer of the recordings. You really have little, if any, control over a producer's publishing, and thus you should try hard to knock this provision out. It's hard to get rid of this, except at superstar levels, but do your best. Companies limit mechanical royalties on CDs in 2 ways. 1. Rate per song. You may remember that the statutory rate in the United States is now 9.1 cents per song. Up until the 1976 Copyright Act, the statutory had been 2 cents for many years. The ink was hardly dry on the 1976 Act, which raised the rate to 2.75 cents, when the record companies hit on the idea that they should require their artists to license controlled compositions at 75% of the statutory rate. Controlled composition clauses existed before the 1976 Copyright Act, but they didn't reduce the rate below statutory. Companies still try for these 75% and 50% rates with most new artists, though it's gotten easier to push this up as the CD sales fall. Even the biggest superstars have some form of controlled composition clause, although the limit is 100% of the minimum statutory rate. 2. Rate per album / EP / single. There is also a limit of 10 or 11 times the single song rate for each album, 5 times for an EP, and 2 times for a single. These issues are much more complex than they seem. So let's take a deeper dive. Maximum rate per song. Because the maximum album rate is a multiple of the single song rate, let's first look at what they do to you on each song. Here's the skinny. The first argument is to make sure you get 100% of statutory rather than their standard off-the-shelf 75% of statutory. As I said, this is getting considerably easier, but if you get a stickler at the label, try to get the percentage over 75%. Anywhere over 75% would be nice. If you can't, one compromise is to ask for an escalation on later albums. For example, you might have a 75% rate on albums 1 and 2, an 85% or 87.5% rate on albums 3 and 4, and 100% after that. Or another possibility is an escalation based on sales. Some companies will include download and streaming equivalents, but some will look only at physical sales. For example, you might get 75% for the first 250,000 or 500,000 album equivalents, 85% for the next 250,000 or 500,000, and 100% thereafter. Some labels offer an incentive for you to sign with their sister publishing company by increasing the mechanical rate to 100% if you give your songs to SIS, or by waiving the 360 participation in publishing income if you sign with their affiliated publisher. Refer back to Chapter 9 for what a 360 participation is. Minimum statutory rate. The limit per composition is based on the minimum statutory rate. This means that all compositions are treated as if they are 5 minutes or less in duration, regardless of their actual playing time. In other words, there is no additional payment for lengthy compositions, as there would be under a compulsory license. For example, the current statutory rate for a 7-minute song is 12.25 cents. Refer back to Chapter 15 for why. But under these provisions, you're only paid 9.1 cents if you get 100% of statutory, or 6.82 cents, 75% of 9.1 cents, if you have a 75% rate. Changes in statutory rate. As we discussed, the statutory rate can be changed by the Copyright Royalty Board. Refer back to Chapter 16. But controlled composition clauses set a rate that doesn't change. Thus, even if you get a full statutory rate in your deal, it's normally locked to the statutory rate on a particular date, and there's no increase if the statutory rate later escalates. This is tough to change, even for superstars. The companies lock into the statutory rate in effect on one of these three dates: A, the date of recording; B, the date the master is delivered to the company; or C, the date of first release of the master. The general thinking, and historically this has been correct, is that the latest possible date is best for you. The statutory rate has never gone down, and thus the longer you wait, the more likely it may go up. However, the rate for physical and downloads has stayed the same since 2006, and I wouldn't expect an increase anytime soon. Free goods, real and imagined. The controlled composition clause will say that you get no mechanicals on free goods. Refer back to the end of Chapter 7 for what free goods are. Nothing wrong with that. The company isn't getting paid for them, so they don't pay mechanicals. Some companies also frame this as a discount of the PPD, rather than free goods. In other words, if they take 10% of the PPD to incentivize dealers to buy them, then 10% of the sales would be deemed free and not bare mechanicals. There are also reduced mechanicals for the deeper discounts of mid-price and budget, which we'll discuss separately. Multiple uses. Controlled composition clauses say that if a particular song is used more than once on the same record, you only get paid as if it were used once. Short uses. The companies don't want to pay for uses under 90 seconds. For intros, a little snippet before another song; interludes, a short piece between songs; or outros, which means either A, a little snippet after a song; or B, a belly button that sticks out. Reduced rates. The company typically asks for a 75% rate for anything other than sales through normal retail channels, and things like mid-price and budget. Refer back to Chapter 12 for what those are. Note, if you have a 75% of statutory rate on top-line product, you'll get a reduced percentage of that already reduced rate. For example, if you had a 75% rate on top-line and a 75% rate on mid-price records, you'd only get 56.25%, 75% of your 75% rate. Public domain arrangements. If a song is an arrangement of a public domain composition, the record company doesn't want to pay you for it. Your argument is that songs like Scarborough Fair were extremely successful public domain songs, and if you're brilliant enough to have this concept, you should be paid. Sorry to use an old song, but I can't think of anything more current. The typical compromise is that you get a proportionate royalty for public domain material, in the same ratio that the performing rights organization, refer back to Chapter 16 for what those are, pays for the composition involved. In other words, if ASCAP pays you 50% of normal performance monies for the song, you get 50% of the mechanical rate. Everyone routinely accepts this, and a lot of forms will say this at the outset to save time. Non-controlled songs. This is a particularly nasty piece of business. The rate limits may be imposed not just on controlled compositions, but on every composition in the album. Most companies don't do this, but there's still a few out there. If you're using outside songs, meaning songs that aren't controlled compositions, this may be impossible to deliver. The owner will tell you to get lost. Remember, you can't force an owner to license you for a first use. And even if the song was used before, the owner doesn't have to take less than the full statutory rate. They can tell you either to drop the song or get a compulsory license at the full statutory rate. The only way to pay less for outside songs is to either threaten, "We'll drop your song if you don't reduce the rate," or grovel, "Please, I'm just a poor little singer." But if you're dealing with major songwriters, unless your records generate truckloads of money, the publisher will tell you to blow it out your kazoo. The real problem is not whether you can deliver the outside song at a reduced rate, because the record companies know there's a lot of times when you can't. The real problem is how the company punishes you when you don't. Essentially, if they have to pay more than your contractual limit because of outside songs, the company carves the excess out of your hide, meaning it reduces the mechanicals going to you, and if that's not enough, it goes hunting for more. Canada. There's no compulsory mechanical rate in Canada. Instead, there's a contractual agreement between the Canadian Recording Industry Association and a number of major publishers, setting the industry royalty rate. Currently, it's 8.3 cents for the first 5 minutes, plus 1.66 cents for each additional minute or fraction thereof, all in Canadian pennies. So now you're a master of the single song limit. You're ready to conquer maximum rate per album, EPs, and singles. The maximum per album concept also applies to EPs and singles, but for simplicity, I'm only talking about albums here. EPs and singles are exactly the same computations, except that the limit is usually 5 times the single song rate for EPs and 2 times for singles. Standard clause. All controlled composition clauses impose a limit on the total mechanicals for each album, which is called a cap. It's usually 10 times 75% of the minimum statutory rate, or 10 times the full rate if your per-song rate isn't reduced. This is known as a 10 times rate, meaning you get 10 times the single-song rate. Note this is an added restriction, which is independent of the per-song limit. In other words, you must deliver each song at the specified single-song rate, no matter what the total album limit. But you can't exceed the total album limit, no matter what you pay for each individual song. This is to keep you from delivering, for example, 14 songs at a 75% rate, which totals more than the company is willing to pay, even though you haven't exceeded your per-song limit. As noted, the album limits are based on a multiple of the minimum statutory rate, the rate for songs 5 minutes and under, as we discussed a little earlier in this chapter. Nowadays, it's not uncommon for albums to have anywhere from 11 to 14 songs, so you should always try for more than a 10 times limit. It's really only a CD issue, and since they're dying, it's been a lot easier to get 11 or 12. Occasionally a little more. Wherever you end up, it's pretty easy to slide right over the limit. Let me show you what happens when you do. Just for consistency in the examples, I'm going to assume that you have a maximum album rate of 10 times 100% of statutory, or 91 cents. Under the standard clause, if you deliver more than 10 songs, the excess reduces the mechanical royalties on songs you control. For example, if you deliver 12 songs that are all controlled, the 10 times cap means you only get 91 cents for all the songs. In other words, each song earns 91 cents divided by 12, or 7.58 cents per song, instead of 9.1 cents per song, which is what you'd get if there were no cap. Special packages / bonus tracks. While this is fading along with CD sales, some artists do special packages exclusively for certain retailers, like Target or Walmart. In exchange for this exclusive product, the retailer gives the product a push, puts it in their brochure, better placement in the store, etc. To make these packages special, they always have more songs than the normal album, usually 2 or 3 bonus tracks. The problem is that the folks who wrote those extra songs have this nasty habit of wanting to be paid mechanicals for them, and you have a limit on mechanicals that's much lower. Normally, this is worked out at the time, but with enough clout, you can get something in your deal. Of course, as the writer, you want to be paid in full for the extra songs. But second place is that the company can't reduce your mechanicals on the original, not bonus, album because of the extras. For example, if you had 10 times full stat for the normal album, and they added 2 tracks, maybe you don't get paid on the extra tracks, but you won't be reduced by third parties who do get paid on them. If your clause doesn't cover special packages, be sure to raise these issues as soon as there's talk of extra tracks. If not, the controlled composition clause will clip your ponytail into a buzz cut. Multiple albums. While these are mostly dead, except for box sets, as we discussed back in Chapter 10, most controlled composition clauses don't distinguish between normal albums and multiple albums. If you don't raise the issue, you'll have a 10-song mechanical limit on a multiple album that has 20 or more songs. As noted earlier, all the economics of a box set are negotiated separately, so you won't likely get much in your normal deal for this. Just be sure mechanicals are part of the discussion when you do a box set, because these are mostly physical product, where this clause is alive and well. Videos. Every controlled composition clause requires you to license your songs for use in videos. There are 2 aspects. 1. Single song videos. Single song videos that play on YouTube, Vevo, etc. are considered promotional because they're free to the consumer and help drive your career. So every controlled comp clause requires you to let the company put these out. If they didn't require it, you could hold them up for ransom by saying they can't do a video without paying you a large fee to use the song that's in it. While it's customary to give them a single song video license, you should get paid by the DSPs. As we discussed, they have to pay under a compulsory license or under a deal with your publisher to stream your videos. The record companies, of course, have no problem with you getting paid by the DSPs, since it doesn't cost them anything. The exception is that the company will want a free license to stream your videos on the label website. The only real issue concerning single-song videos is whether you give your label a free sync license to put the song in the video in the first place. See the beginning of this chapter for what a sync license is. That's separate from the right to stream. It's a fee to duplicate your music into the video, as opposed to a fee for streaming the video, which is a distribution license. Currently, the custom is to give a free sync license under your controlled comp clause, since you're getting paid for the streaming. The other issue swirling around these days concerns lyric videos. Those are videos that show the lyrics on screen while the song is playing. Most publishers want an additional royalty for lyric videos, arguing that it involves a separate right to reprint the lyrics, which it does. The labels fight back fiercely. Your controlled comp usually says they get the lyrics for free, and results vary with Clout. More often than not, you won't get anything extra for the lyric video. But if there is an additional fee, it's a couple of percentage points in addition to the normal rate. 2. Everything besides single song videos. This would be things like concert videos, TV appearances, compilations of single song videos, and porcelain unicorns. Just kidding about the last one. It doesn't matter that everything besides streaming is drying up like a forgotten potted fern. These rates still make their way into your controlled comp clause. For DVDs and video downloads, independent publishers, those not subject to a controlled composition clause, who can charge what the market will bear, usually get in the range of 8 cents to 15 cents per song, though some get a percentage of PPD, 8% to 10% or so. Also, there's almost always a 10,000 to 15,000 unit guarantee, meaning, for example, if you get 12 cents per unit and a 10,000 unit guarantee, you would get a $1,200 advance, 12 cents times 10,000 units. In addition, they often get something called a fixing fee, which is a non-recoupable payment for fixing the song in the video, basically a sync license. These fees range from $250 to $500 per song. You won't get market rate for these uses, but you should be able to get paid for video downloads and DVDs. The common compromise is around 8 cents per song if it's a penny rate, or 8% if it's a percentage of PPD. You virtually never get a fixing fee. Other freebies. The other freebies that the label will want under your controlled comp clause are the right to use your song in advertising and promoting your record and on their website. Producers. When you hire a producer who is also a writer, you'll discover that the major producers don't want to be bound by your controlled composition clause and will insist on a full rate for their songs, no matter what. If you have enough clout, or if the producer doesn't, you can get them to go along with your controlled comp clause completely. Even if the producer has moderate clout, if your clause is reasonably favorable, you can sometimes get them to sign off. But a number of the major producers insist on a full rate with no cap on the number of songs. For example, if you have a 10 times cap, but 12 songs on the album, you'll only be paid 10/12 of the full rate. If the producer insists on a 100% mechanical rate for their writing, you'll have to eat the difference between that and the 10/12 rate you're getting for those songs. However you end up, even if you give the producer a full rate, be sure they agree to be bound by the other terms of your controlled comp clause, videos, marketing, etc. Postscript. Now that you've heard about it, I didn't want to prejudice you before you did. I can tell you that controlled composition clauses are among the most complicated critters in the music business. You probably figured that out on your own, huh? This section is packed full of weird concepts, so it may take a few times through to get the flavor. Don't feel bad if you miss some of it the first few times. It took me years to get a decent handle on this stuff. And now you can feel even better that it's disappearing. Answer to question back in the sub-publisher charges section earlier in this chapter about a deal where the local sub-publisher kept no percentage whatsoever of the earnings, i.e. they remitted 100%? And could you figure out why anyone would do this? While it was a stupid business deal, the sub-publisher's thinking was that A, it would have a certain amount of prestige from having landed a major catalog, which prestige immediately vanished when everyone found out what an idiotic deal they made. B, even though the sub-publisher kept no peace, it collected the monies and held them for a period of 6 months, which meant the company could earn interest on them. This was back in the days when interest actually meant something. And C, the publisher got a bump on its share of black box monies, which were very meaningful in those days, and not customarily shared with the original publisher. If you find someone ready to make a deal like this, give me a call, because I still have that land in Florida for sale. Bonus section. How to set up a publishing company. I am now about to save you an enormous amount of time and frustration in setting up a publishing company. The tips I'm giving you here, revealed in print and in audio for the first time, were gained by yours truly through a series of hard knocks that will become obvious as you see the proper way to do it. The absolute first thing to do. Before you do anything, and I mean before you do anything, you positively must take this first step. Affiliate your company with ASCAP or BMI, or if you're an established writer, CSAC or GMR. You have to do this first because the PROs won't let you use a name that's the same as or similar to the name of an existing company. That's for the very good reason that they don't want to accidentally pay the wrong party. So you don't want to have label copy, copyright registrations, and everything else in the name of a company that can't collect performance royalties. You can affiliate and secure your name by completing an application and giving the PRO 3 name choices, ranked in order. That way, at least one of the names should clear. If you're also a songwriter and haven't yet affiliated, you should affiliate as a writer with one of the societies at the same time. They won't let you affiliate with more than one as a writer. You'll have to affiliate as a publisher with the same society that you affiliate with as a songwriter, because the societies insist on having a song's publisher affiliated with the same society as the song's writer. For the same reason, if you're going to be a real publisher, meaning you're going to publish other people's songs as opposed to only your own, you'll need to have several companies, one for each PRO. The publishing company affiliation forms are pretty straightforward. They ask you who owns the company, your address, and similar exciting questions. You also need to give them information about all the songs in your catalog, writers, publishers, foreign deals, recordings, etc., so they can put the info into their system and make sure you're properly credited, read, paid. You can get affiliation applications by contacting ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, or GMR at ASCAP, www.ascap.com, BMI, www.bmi.com, CSAC, only by invitation, www.csac.com, GMR, only by invitation, www.globalmusicrights.com. Here's a tip in picking a name. The more common your name, the less likely you're going to get it. So steer clear of names like Hit Music, Smash Tunes, and similar choices that, because they're obnoxiously obvious, won't clear. Names using just initials, such as JB Music, also seem to have a hard time clearing, so save that concept for your license plates. For some reason, many of my clients name publishing companies after their streets or their dogs or their children, and these seem to clear routinely, assuming your kid's name isn't Smash. Also, get started early. It can take about 5 weeks to get an approval. Setting up business. If you're doing business as a corporation, LLC, or other entity, and using the registered entity name for your publishing company, you can skip the next step. But if you're an individual doing business under a publishing company name, or if you're an entity using a different name for the publishing company, then you have to file what in California is known as a fictitious business name statement. This is a document that's filed with a county recorder and also published, and it has its counterpart in most states. It tells the world that you're doing business under a name that isn't your own and makes it legal to do so. At least in California, you need this statement to open a bank account and, even more important, to cash checks made out to that name. You can imagine the screaming phone call I got as a young lawyer when I learned this lesson. Copyright registration. Next, register the songs with the Copyright Office in the name of your publishing company. Refer to the Registration and Deposit section of Chapter 20. If the songs were previously copyrighted in your name, you need to file an assignment transferring them to the publisher's name. By the way, if you're thinking of using an LLC, corporation, or other legal entity, be sure you get tax advice first. There are some serious tax consequences to holding copyrights in these entities, and you should be sure it's cool for you. PRO registration. To the extent you didn't do it when you originally affiliated, you need to register all your songs with the Performing Rights Society. That authorizes them to license those particular songs, collect the money, and pay you. Once you have an account set up, you can register the songs online, and it's pretty self-explanatory. After that, you're in business. You can issue licenses to record companies and other users, as well as make foreign sub-publishing agreements, print deals, and so forth. However, there's no particular need to rush into these deals, nor will anybody be interested, until you have a record released or some other exploitation, like a film or TV show using your songs. In fact, if you don't have something like this going, the societies won't even let you affiliate, and frankly, there's not much point in doing any of this. You'll just be all dressed up with no place to go. Chapter 18. Songwriter, Co-Publishing, and Administration Deals. Okay, you now understand where publishing money comes from. Let's look at how you can get the most of it when you make a deal for your songs. There are two primary deal types: a songwriter agreement, also called a co-publishing agreement, and an administration or co-administration deal. Let's start with a songwriter agreement, which means a deal between you as a creative songwriter and a publisher who's going to handle your business. What's that look like? Songwriter agreements. The first issue, of course, is what percentage of the earnings do you get? The most common starting deals are 75%. But if you've got enough heat and bargaining power, you can get up to 90%, rarely more, unless you're the most mega of stars. In addition to clout, the higher percentages also depend on whether you want the biggest possible advance. The smaller the advance you take, the easier to get a larger piece of the earnings. Historically, a songwriter agreement meant a contract that gave the publisher 100% ownership of the copyright, and in exchange, the writer got 50% of the income. This is where the terms writer's share and publisher share that we previously discussed each came to mean 50% of the income. If the writer gets more than 50%, they were, under the industry terms of those days, getting the writer's share plus a piece of the publisher's share. And because they had a share of publishing, these deals were called co-publishing agreements. In fact, there were sometimes two contracts, one for the 50% writer's share, and the second for a share of the publishing income. Nowadays, everyone just simplifies things in one contract for a larger percentage. These deals are called songwriters' agreements, but because they include a piece of the historical publisher share, they're also referred to as co-publishing agreements. Some of these deals try to charge an administration fee, also called an admin fee, which is usually 10% of the money. The admin fee comes off the top, before deducting expenses, and it's really just a way of changing your split while trying to make you feel like you got more. For example, if you have a 75% split, and they take a 10% administration fee off the top, that leaves 90%. So your 75% of 90% only leaves you 67.5%. The major companies who do their own administration will generally knock out the administration fee and just state the real percentage. but you have to be precise when you negotiate splits, or you could be rudely surprised. For example, say 75-25 with no admin fee. If you're dealing with an independent company that licenses another publisher to do their administration, you'll generally have to live with that third-party fee coming off the top. In this case, find out in advance how much the administrator charges. You need to know, because it directly affects what goes into your pocket, as you just saw. Sometimes, if you have a lot of clout, you can make the independent publisher take the administration fee out of their share and not charge you with any of it. But this is very hard to pull off. What's in the pot? Songwriter contracts define the pot of income that your percentage applies to. So you want to make sure there's as much money as possible in that pot. Here's what to look for. At source. You want your deal to be at source. As we discussed back in Chapter 9, that means your percentage applies to the earnings in each territory, without reduction for the local sub-publisher share. Fight hard for this. You should almost always be able to get paid at source for affiliated sub-publishers, meaning sub-publishers who are owned or controlled by your publisher. And when you make a deal with a major publisher, that covers the biggest earning territories in the world. But when you're dealing with an independent publisher, they're licensing their songs to third-party sub-publishers. That means you can't get at source because your publisher is being charged by someone else before the money comes back to them. If you have a massive amount of clout, you might make your publisher eat some or all of the sub-publisher's fee, but this is incredibly rare. If you can't get paid at source, you should make sure that your publisher's deals with their sub-publishers are all at source. That at least ensures that your publisher's income, in which you share, is the largest possible amount, because there can't be any deductions besides the sub-publisher's fees. And speaking of those fees, your deal should limit what the sub-publishers can charge to, say, 15% to 25% for third-party sub-publishers, and maybe 10% to 20% for sub-publishers owned by your publisher. Performance monies. As we discussed back in Chapter 16, the performing rights societies pay songwriters directly instead of paying the publisher, which is what happens with every other type of income. In other words, you get 50% of the performance money, the writer's share, directly from your PRO, and your publisher only collects the other 50%, the publisher's share. For this reason, publishers want to pay you a smaller percentage of performance monies. For example, if you have a 75-25 deal, they'll want to pay you only 50% of performance monies. They make exactly the same argument we discussed back in Chapter 17 in the sub-publishing context. You get the writer's share directly from the PRO, which is 50% of the total income, plus 50% of the 50% publisher share, 25% of 100% of the performance money, which gives you a total of 75% of the income. You might want to refer quickly back at that section and the chart in the PDF, which lays it all out. It's usually worth pushing back on this, and with substantial clout, you may do a bit better. But in the beginning and even mid-level stages, expect to take a reduced piece of the publisher's performance money. Another issue concerning performing rights money is something called direct licensing. Recall that your deal with the PRO gives them the right to license your songs as part of their blanket license. Refer back to Chapter 16. Under the consent decree, we also discussed in Chapter 16, however, all the rights you give your PRO have to be non-exclusive, which means you're free to bypass the PRO and directly issue performance licenses to any user you'd like. In other words, you can issue a direct license. For example, you could directly license a nightclub or a local TV station to play your music. And because your publisher has the exclusive right to do all your licensing, the publisher could issue a direct license of your songs to a user. This right hadn't really been used much, but a few years ago, there were rumblings that publishers might issue direct performance licenses to the DSPs for streaming rights, rather than use the PROs to issue those licenses. In other words, they might tell Spotify that they didn't need a BMI license for your songs because the publisher would give them a performance license directly. If they did this, all the performance money, writers and publisher shares, would be paid to the publisher, so the writer would no longer get any streaming performance money from the PRO. Instead, the streaming performance money would go into the pot with all the other money that the publisher collects, and the publisher would pay you the agreed percentage. While direct licensing has gone quiet for the moment, those of us who represent writers made very loud noises about the idea that a publisher could collect the writer's share of performance monies. For starters, it would take you longer to get your money. The publisher would get it when the PRO would have otherwise paid you, but the publisher wouldn't fork it over to you until the next accounting period. Far more serious, however, is that it would also mean the publisher could use this money to recoup your advance. Remember, they can't do that now because the money doesn't go through their hands. And if you weren't careful in your contract language, they could even pay you a reduced split on the writer's performance monies, 50% instead of the 75% you get on all other income. So for this reason, you need to limit the reduced percentage of performance monies to situations where the writer is paid directly by the PRO. And on top of all this, direct licensing could kill the PROs by diverting a massive amount of their income to the publishers. In response to our squawking, the publishers all said they would pay writers outside recoupment, even if the contract didn't say so. In fact, they even discussed using the PROs to administer and collect these monies and pay writers, which would make sure that happened. However, I would put in your contract that if a society no longer pays writers directly, or if a publisher directly licenses performance rights, the publisher has to pay out of the writer's share, even if the writer is unrecouped. Your argument is that the publisher never expected to have these monies for recoupment anyway. Speaking of recoupment from a writer's performance monies, there are some new developments in this area as well. Historically, the societies were so protective of a writer being paid directly by the PRO that they wouldn't honor an assignment of performance royalties by the writer. This, however, has been eroding for some time. The first change was that the societies agreed to honor an assignment of performance monies to a publisher who paid an advance to the writer. And they also agreed to honor an assignment of royalties to a bank that loaned money to the writer. But those assignments were limited to the amount of the advance or loan. Today, the PROs will sometimes, reluctantly, honor an overall assignment of monies, but they require a lot of paperwork to make sure the writer really understands what they're doing and that it's really what the writer wants. Catch-all. Some contracts, though thankfully this seems to be disappearing, say the songwriter gets a percentage of the publisher's receipts from a list of revenue, like mechanical, performance, print, and sync, or words to similar effect. The problem is that the language is sometimes a limited list of income sources, which means that the publisher could be collecting monies that it doesn't share with the writer. This is definitely something to avoid if you're a songwriter, and it's easily solved by adding a catch-all, which is language to the effect of all other income not stated herein, or just by defining gross receipts that go into the pot as all income relating to exploitations of your songs. Share of advances. Most contracts also say you don't share in advances that the publisher gets. Most of the time, this is fine. If the publisher gets an advance for its entire catalog of songs, of which you're only a part, you really have no right to share in that advance until your song has earnings that are used toward recoupment. There's no way to know whose songs will earn back the advance, and so there's no reasonable way to allocate a portion of the advance to any particular song until royalties are earned. What you can share, however, is an advance paid specifically for your composition. For example, your song's lyrics are licensed for a book, and the publisher gets an advance against a royalty for that use. Refer back to the printed music section of Chapter 17. Since this advance or guarantee is only for your song's earnings and doesn't have to be repaid if there's no earnings, you should get your share when the advance/guarantee is paid to the publisher. So add language saying you do share in advances and guarantees that are specifically for your composition. We discussed the concept of breakage, unrecouped advances, non-recoupable money, equity from investments, back in Chapter 12, in connection with record companies. This concept also applies to publishers, so you should ask for a share of that in your deal. Most of the companies do it as a matter of policy, even if it's not in your deal, but it's cheap insurance to put in that provision. Print income. As we discussed back in Chapter 17, physical printed music consists primarily of single-song sheet music and multi-song folio books. Not surprisingly, the physical market is shrinking as the digital revolution takes hold. We discussed digital print rights also in Chapter 17. All but one of the major publishers now treat print income the same as all other income, because none of them are in the print manufacturing and distribution business. In other words, they license print rights just like any other rights, and you get your agreed percentage of it. The holdout publisher has old contracts with major writers from its golden era that would get an increase in royalties if they switched over to the new system, so they hang on to the old one, which is pennies for single-song sheet music and royalties based on wholesale for other print uses. If you're dealing with them, try to get a percentage of publishing on top of those royalties to make up the difference. As we discussed back in Chapter 17, publishers can get a higher royalty for use of your name and likeness in a personality folio. If you have enough clout, you can ask that the full bump in royalty come to you, or at least a chunk of it. The argument is that this is for your name and likeness, and the publisher shouldn't share in it. Their argument is that they do have the right to your name and likeness in connection with print music. No playing footsie. If the publishing company is affiliated with your record company, you want to make sure they don't issue sweetheart licenses, i.e., licenses at less than customary rates, to their own record company. In other words, you don't want them playing footsie with their sister companies at your expense. Another example would be where their parent company also owns a film studio, and you don't want them to license your songs into one of their films for a smaller sync fee than what's fair in the marketplace. So add a provision saying that licenses to their affiliated companies must be on an arm's-length, customary basis. Charges against royalties. Okay, so now we have this nice fat pot of money. Let's look at what the publisher takes out before they pay you. Off-the-top charges. The publisher will take the following off-the-top, meaning it's deducted before they apply your percentage. In other words, they bear their percentage share of these costs. Off-the-top costs are typically 1. Sub-publishing fees, refer back to Chapter 17, unless your deal is at source, in which case there shouldn't be any. 2. Collection costs, which means A. monies deducted by collection agencies, such as Harry Fox fees or CMRRA, refer back to Chapter 16, and B. the cost of chasing deadbeats who don't pay. 3. Costs of sample clearances, refer back to Chapter 17. 4. Demos. We'll discuss them in a minute.